10 minutes after 8 o'clock, John Landecker welcoming back to the program Rod Pyle from Ad Astra Magazine. Good evening, Rod. How you doing?
Good evening. I'm glad to be here and hoping you'll forgive me for making you watch Iron Sky.
Well, now, wait a minute. No, I started to overanalyze. So
that's a mistake with this one.
Okay, so Iron Sky, I was into it for about 15 minutes.
Because it opens in a very promising way, right?
Right. So, well, you should tell them what happens in the opening, how this unfolds, how these Nazis got into the...
Right. What
the Nazis have to do with it?
So an American expedition lands on the moon, and the two astronauts, one white, one African-American, get out of their capsule, and the racial thing is important in a minute, and they're walking around, and the white guy walks over to a hummock and looks and sees on the other side. He says, "Oh, my God," and it's a huge Nazi base on the moon in a building shaped like a swastika, which is very clever, and then the Nazi soldiers come up and shoot him and grab the other guy. And that's kind of the high point of the film in a lot of ways.
Yes, it is.
And then I think it's best described, and I'm paraphrasing what some of the reviewers said, but basically they said it's a great core idea with great visual effects wrapped in terrible execution as a movie with mostly awful performances. And I have a connection to this film because a friend of mine who I hired back in 1991 when I was producing shorts for Disney, he was a PA on one of my films, but I found out he was a writer, and I later saw his name pop up on this thing, and I called him and said, "Mike, what happened? I know you're better than that." And he said, "Dude," I turned in a script, and they had their way with it. So I think at the core of this is, this was a production of a Finnish director and production company in alliance with Germany and Australia. Now, Australians can hang. The Finns and the Germans aren't normally the place you go for stand-up comedy, especially if they're trying to channel American pop culture and racial issues.
Yeah.
And that's where I think it came off the rails, between that and the woman pretending to be Sarah Palin as the president. You know, like you said, you're 15, 30 minutes into it, and you start thinking, how many movies are in this thing? It was wild.
Yes, and you mentioned that one of the astronauts is African-American, and in the process of the movie, they change the pigment on the skin so he looks like the Wayman brothers in White Chicks.
That funny?
No. I didn't understand the reason at all that that happened. And, you know, there's an attack, and there's your basic, we have Nazis that have been up at the moon since, 1945 or something, according to this movie?
Yeah. Well, and delightfully, so they flee there after the war and set up shop, but their technology hasn't advanced at all, so they have computers the size of rooms, and everything's on big gauges and vacuum tubes and stuff. So the production design was great. The sets were great. The effects were great, and everything else kind of sucked.
So they're Nazis, right? This is just a quick aside that we're going to take a break and come back. So there's Nazis on the moon, and they get into their spaceships, which of course you got to have.
Flying saucers.
They come down to Earth, and they decide to go to the movie, and the movie's The Great Dictator, which is which is Charlie Chaplin in a silent film in which he just skewers Hitler. And I'm like, this film has some really bizarre moments, I just have to say. We'll be back with more on 720 WGN. So you're watching this movie, or you're going to start watching this movie, and it's sci-fi, and it's already established that, you know, they're going to the moon. And then this music starts.
Right.
And I'm like, what is this?
Well, and isn't that the story of the whole film?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's these really great moments. I mean, the score runs from that to Wagner, lots of Wagner.
Right.
And, you know, the key actors were pretty good, I thought. The guy that plays the Führer in making is good. The woman is great. The astronaut's great. Even the guy that plays the Hitler stand-in is pretty good. And then, so we get through the middle of it, and so now the Nazis are attacking Earth because they're going to retake Earth and cure the ills of Earth.
And, you know, by the way, eugenics. They're ticked off because the American astronauts have better computers than they had, the Nazis, and they want to get their hands on some iPhones and iPads, which they do,
right, by the way. Because the iPad is what ultimately powers the big ending machine, which is the Götterdämmerung, which is this continent-sized spaceship with all kinds of pistons and things going.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's what gets me. So they have the big fight. So the smaller German ships, which look like zeppelins and flying saucers, of course, are attacking Earth. Out of nowhere come all the Earth spaceships looking like, you know, things made out of Tinker Toys, but okay. And they're fighting back, and it's kind of it's a draw, you know, the Germans are sort of losing, as they have been known to do. And then Götterdämmerung shows up, and it's wiping everybody out. But no, at the last minute, the Americans strike back with nukes, and that's the end of that. And then, after the Germans are beaten, suddenly all the international forces of Earth start attacking each other. And then in the end credits, you see they're launching nuclear missiles at each other. And it's like, what?
Well, then you're trying to say to yourself, okay, we've got some sort of author's note here. We've got some sort of message thing happening because,
you know, in social commentary.
Yeah, in the trailer I played, the president, the line is something along the lines of, everybody knows. What was it that if you any American president starts a war will be reelected or something like that in the first term?
Right.
So, I mean, that's not a normal line in a movie.
That's not a normal line. Neither is the one that follows it, which is, you know, I'm like Franklin D. Roosevelt, but you know, I ain't spastic. Really?
Wow.
This is true Finnish humor at its best. Yeah, you know, this is what happens when you spend the last 100 years facing down the Soviet Union on your nearest border.
I guess so. But I mean, and as you say, all the planets, all the worlds are fighting each other at the end, and you know, they leave you in the midst of war, and in the beginning, the president, you know, says something like that, and somewhere in here is a message, but I'm not quite sure what it is. But it's certainly not. I wouldn't say it's pro USA. You know,
well, not when the president is obviously Sarah Palin.
Yes, true. Yeah.
That was the other weird part. Now, get this, though. They made two sequels and a video game.
You're kidding.
So the first sequel was part small studio money and crowdfunding. The second sequel, for obvious reasons, was completely crowdfunded and involved lizard people at the center of the earth and Nazis riding dinosaurs, because why not? And fortunately, they all bombed miserably. So that was the end. By 2022, this company was out of business. But they had a 10-year run making Nazis on the moon. And, you know, you can't go wrong.
When you say crowdsourcing, you mean that the movie was made by individual contributions and not a studio? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. So the first film was, at the time, the most expensive Finnish film ever made, as you can see by the visual effects.
I mean, you know.
But that's a pretty small family of work, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was studio and production company money. But then when they got to the sequels, it was basically went on Kickstarter and said, hey, give us your money and we'll make this film and take your suggestions. And that's what they're doing.
So how much money would they raise in a Kickstarter campaign to make a movie? It had to be hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I think it was $17 million or something.
What?
All in. Yeah.
You're kidding me.
I don't know how much of that came from crowdfunding. I think most of it was like investor money. But all I can say is both the crowds and the investors must have been pretty unhappy at the end of the day.
Well, I don't know what would have attracted them to. Maybe they saw something in this movie that I didn't. But like I said at the beginning of this, I was really into it for a while. Oh, here come that. What's this crazy music they're playing at the beginning? This isn't war music or sci-fi music or, you know, science fiction music of any kind. It sounds like a 1940s, you know, June Allison singing something or other. And then Nazis are there. And they've got a their building is in the form of a swastika. And I'm like, what's going on? This is.
But at that point, it's still kind of zany, and you're thinking, well, yes, this could be fun.
Yeah.
And then it just goes off the rails. Yeah.
Well, once the Nazis actually get involved with the astronauts, oh, wait, hold on. Before we leave this picture. So, where did I put it? One of these astronauts is African-American in the movie Iron Sky. And I had an article somewhere. I'm so disoriented. I disorganized about Artemis II. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is going to go up around the moon, not on the moon.
Right. Right.
And for the first time, there will be an African-American astronaut. And I thought, this coincidence is just ridiculous.
You think we need to send him a copy of the movie?
No, but I mean, I watch a movie and one of the astronauts is African-American and I don't really think anything about it at all. I mean, it doesn't register to me like, oh, there are no African-American astronauts. I don't think anything about it. And then I read this news story about what's actually going on with the trip to the moon. And they say that, and also a woman, I believe, first female.
Right.
But the first African American astronaut, and I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, it's great, but what a coincidence that movie. And then you think back on the movie, and you're like, well, now wait a minute. They obviously had something in mind when they did that, because you just don't do something in a movie without a reason or a purpose. And then they changed.
There's a conspiracy.
And then, then they changed the color of the African American skin, which I don't get that at all.
Which wasn't funny at all.
Yeah. No. And then I don't know. It was just reality imitating art to a certain degree, or maybe that's not the right way to put it.
Kind of like a space age Austin Powers on LSD, I think.
Well, that might be a good slog line if you put that on. If you put that on the movie poster, on an ad, I think people would be, oh, really? I might be interested in that.
Would a different title have worked, like Lost in Space?
Well, this is Iron Sky. You know, like,
no, we want people to want to see it, not be running from the theater because they're afraid they're going to see Billy Mummy and Dr. Smith. You bubble-headed movie? We don't need that. Actually, I thought, again, like John's kind of leading to, I think the tagline for the movie was okay. The title was okay. The setup was great.
Yeah.
And then it just falls apart after the first half hour. And you're thinking, boy, did you guys miss an opportunity? Now, I will admit, I did not see the sequel. I'll have to watch that.
Oh, please. I don't think we have to do that, do we?
I won't bring it. No, I won't bring it to you. I'm just curious now because I want to see Nazis and dinosaurs and lizard
people.
Well,
that might. Okay. Now, what's the name of the sequel?
It's Iron Sky 2.
Oh, how original. Okay.
What is the name of it? I had it here somewhere.
I wouldn't mind watching
The Coming Race. The Coming Race.
Oh, my God.
Which is also, again, this is like, okay, the Finns have been drinking again, you know?
No doubt. I mean, or it gives us an insight into, well, at least the how they perceive things here, so to speak, and a couple of levels, race, war, things of that nature, iPads, cell phones.
Yeah. iPads that control the Goddard
dam. I mean, it's like, okay, it would be like if you had, a remote controlled, a toy blimp or a remote controlled, little airplane or something. Except that in this case, you've got the controller and the iPad, and you're controlling this huge, gigantic German war Zeppelin. I don't know. It looked like, the Hindenburg, but with armor. And it's crazy. Oh, well.
But to be honest, compared to what we did during the Apollo era in the 60s, you probably could control a spacecraft that big with an iPad because Apollo was controlled with something about as smart as your digital watch. Not even.
Right.
So. Isn't there a submarine out there that some functions can be handled with a controller from a video game, from one of the an Xbox.
That was the Titan that got crushed while they were diving on the Titanic. Yeah, it was run by an Xbox controller.
Yeah, that's right.
Probably not well advised.
On that happy
or
note,
maybe more training was needed. Who knows?
We'll be back with our second feature. Don't go
with
away.
With a good movie.
Yes, it's good and it's fun. But right now, it's the bottom of the hour and time to get into the WGN newsroom. Yes. First Man on the Moon, 720 WGN, John Landecker, along with Rod Pyle from Ad Astra Magazine. We're talking about movies that Rod has suggested. And
you're blaming me.
Well, got to make it clear, because I'd never seen it. I'd never seen this one.
You hadn't?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
First Man on the Moon.
First Man on the Moon, yeah.
Yeah, 1964. So here's the deal. Once again, it's the okay, let's call it the present time. And astronauts are going to the moon. And they go to the moon. And they get out of their moon lander and they're starting to walk around the moon. And they walk and they walk and they're walking around the moon. And lo and behold, there on a rock is the flag, the British flag.
Union
what do
Jack.
You call it? The Union Jack. There's a Union Jack, right? On the moon on a rock. And there is a note next to it.
Claiming the moon for Queen Victoria. Which is great. Now, interestingly.
How could that be?
I just realized today that movie was made just about 61 years after the book was written in 1901, 63 years.
H.G. Wells.
And it's been just about that same length of time between that movie and today when we're talking about it. So historically, it's kind of right in the middle, which really makes me feel like an old guy.
Well, we'll pass on that. But anyway, you know, so you're up on the moon. You're a present-day astronaut. You find the Union Jack and a note. So what to do, what to do. So back down on Earth, they start tracing, trying to find relatives of the guy that wrote the note, I guess. And they find that, what is he? His grandfather, his great-grandfather, whatever, somebody who's related is, you know, really old and is in a home. And the staff doesn't show movies to him of the sci-fi nature because he gets a little excited.
Right.
Because he claims that he has this story. And so eventually the old guy starts to tell the story. And all of a sudden we're back to what year did we suddenly return to?
I think it's everything Wells did seemed to really focus on the turn of the century. So sometime in the late 1800s. I think it's 1899. Yeah.
Okay, so now we're in 1899. So if you watch The Time Machine, and maybe you have, imagine it's sort of like Time Machine-like right there. I mean, you've got a bunch of English folks interested in a variety of scientific things, and one of them has built a container/spaceship, right? And he has this. Remember the movie The Absent-Minded Professor, and he had this thing called Flubber. And with Flubber, he would like put it on anything, and when you had Flubber on, you could bounce, you could go crazy. Well, there's a Flubber-like compound that this guy has put together.
Cavorite.
Cavorite is what he called it. And he covers his little capsule thing with Cavorite, and, you know, there's no engines, there's no anything that has anything to do with flying into outer space. And yet this thing covered in this Cavorite goes all the way to the moon. Just like that. And we'll take it from there. Then they get out on the moon and apparently they can breathe the air. And
no, they're wearing deep diving suits.
From 20,000 leagues, from 20,000 leagues under the sea.
Exactly. Yeah. The only thing that got me as a kid is they weren't wearing gloves. Of course, their hands would have exploded, but that's okay. And they're walking around the moon exploring, leaving the woman. Now, so there's the crazy professor. There's the kind of doltish young He-Man.
Yes.
And then there's his fiance. And the only reason the fiance comes with them is because the dolt has sort of been cheating her out of money for years. He's just kind of a cad. So she's actually run over to where he and Kava are working on the sphere before they leave Earth, banging on the side with an elephant gun saying, "Get out here. You're going to pay for my cabin or I'm going to blow your head off." And they realize that the paint is just dried on the sphere and they're about to take off. So they grab her and pull her inside and off they go. So we have the crazy professor, played by Lionel Jeffries, who was great, a little over the top, but great. This fiercely independent woman, which is pretty unusual for 1964. She wasn't in the book. And then the cad who, when he gets to the moon, you know, Dr. Kaver just wants to communicate with the moon beings they call Selenites, try and understand them and share culture. And of course, the cad just wants to shoot everything. And the woman is kind of left behind through most of the film until she's captured. I did want to say, like a lot of other H.G. Wells stuff, if you read the book and really kind of look between the lines of the film, once again, there's social commentary here. You know, it was this commentary on human nature, our aggressive nature, in particular the British Empire, kind of an indictment of imperialism, the way they treat the moon creatures. And it was really more nuanced than almost any other science fiction of its time. Kind of like the movie Zulu, it portrays the bad guys with respect, you know. And the Selenites never incite any violence. It's always the Earth people, and they respond to it. So I thought that was, you know, pretty forward-looking for that time.
And this whole, by the way, the, I would say, what, 90% of the movie is this flashback. That's the story that's being told by the elderly gentleman who's in the home in England in quote unquote current times. And all of this is his story that's unfolding. And before we get to the next thing, which I think is really important, by the way, we'll take a break and come back in 720 WGN. The movie is First Men in the Moon, also known as H.G. Wells' First Men in the Moon, 1964. We're talking to Rod Pyle from Ad Astra magazine about this. And we've established that Americans, well, did it say, are they American astronauts or they're sort of an international crew?
It says United Nations on the side, which was kind of a forward-looking thing for the
Well,
time,
I guess yeah. I missed that. So they go to the moon and they're walking around and they find the Union Jack and a note, okay? So, like, they're not the first people at the moon. And right. So we find a guy on Earth who's old, and he starts telling the story of this whole thing and how they went up to the moon. And so they're on the moon. And then they run into these creatures, and they have confrontations, and so on and so forth. And that's when I want to bring in the name of Ray Harryhausen.
Yes.
Yes, because that's a name I think a lot of people know. I knew, and he is the, what's the animation, the stop animation?
It's stop action, but he called it Dynamation and Dynascope.
Yeah. Now, you've seen this. I know you have. The Seven Voyages of Sinbad, Clash of the Titans, Jason and the Argonauts, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, all of this stop
action. You're setting my heart aflutter, John, with all these movies you're mentioning.
You know, this is the guy that did all of that, and he is responsible for the effects of those of that type in this movie, and I thought that was really intriguing. That he worked on this film.
It's funny. Some classic Harryhausen fans kind of dismissed this film because it only had three or four scenes that actually used the Dynamation process, which isn't just stop action. It's stop action against a rear projection screen that frame by frame is projecting the scene they're in. He moves the puppets to match that, and then they had to put a pane of glass in front of that and paint these traveling mats on it. So it's this very involved process, but they did use it for some of the more memorable scenes. Some of the scenes with the Selenites, the moon insect people, are Dynamation and the rest are guys in rubber suits. Those were children, by the way, because they needed little tiny people. So all the rubber suit Selenites attacking them, you know, the scene before the big caterpillar gets killed and all that, are children jumping on. But I thought, you know, all the Harryhausen stop action scenes were great, but I think my favorite of all, and it wasn't just how it was done, it was how it was scripted, was when Caver's walking up the steps to meet with the Moon King called the Grand Lunar. And he's in this big kind of force fieldy thing. And he's, you know, got a bigger brain than everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
And, but, you know, the writing of that scene, the dialogue between the professor and the Grand Lunar, I thought, you know, for this kind of a movie, you know, the budget's $1.6 million. Sci-fi is still considered kid stuff, was pretty well written and almost kind of philosophical.
Oh, definitely. I think that there's a lot of that going on in this.
Yeah.
With the interaction between certain astronauts who are the good guys and one of them who's not. And, you know, there's underlying messages and all of that. And who instigates these conflicts. And I just got a lot out of that. And the scene that you're talking about is like going to see Oz. You know what I mean? It's like, you're going to, here's the brains behind everything. I mean, the big brain. I don't know if that character really controls all the other moon people creatures, but.
Well, in the book he does. And again, this is Wells, you know, in the book, the moon is a caste system. There's classes of workers, there's classes of thinkers, there's classes of laborers, there's classes of breeders. So it's very insectoid. But again, you know, this is Wells making comments on the British class system and possibly the caste system in India, since that was contemporaneous.
Yes.
And, you know, in the book, it's a huge society. It fills the everything in the moon is underground. There's miles and miles of tunnels, of course, in this movie. They couldn't afford that, but I thought most of the sets were miniatures done with green screen or BIPAC printing, where they just print one scene into another. And, you know, you can see fuzzy lines and stuff, but I thought to convey the scale of all this, for the time, it was really quite good.
Oh, no, I thought it was really quite good for 1964, and I'm sorry I hadn't seen it, because I thought if I had seen it in 1964, I was a junior in high school, I'd have loved it.
You were a junior in high school in 1964? I thought you were my age, dude.
Well, I don't know what your age is, but
I just turned 69.
Oh, I'm almost 10 years older than you are.
Well, you don't show it.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You had to say that. No. I used to go to those
Under contract.
I mean, I'd go to the movies all the time, and that would be right up my alley. When I was in high school. But seeing it now, you know, it does, some of it is so, well, H.G. Wells is imagining this, so it can't be based on scientific fact. I mean, the capsule, the if you want to call it a capsule, I mean, they made it out of wood, I think, and they applied this stuff to it, and this compound, which elevates this capsule all the way to the moon, and they eventually can breathe the air in the moon. And, I mean, there's obviously things that science developed later that are not of that nature. You know what I mean? What I'm trying to say?
But a lot of these were inventions of the movie because the producer, Charles Schneer, who did most of these Harryhausen films, was trying to make it contemporary enough that it would still be viewable in a few years after the real moon landing happened. In the book, the moon has an atmosphere because we didn't know any better.
Okay.
And the sphere is made out of iron, and Caverite just cuts off gravity. So if you buy that theory, then when you close those shutters over the windows and you remove gravity from that side, it's going to be, you know, pushed in one direction and sucked in the other. So it's kind of like warp drive almost in a way. So, you know, I mean, Wells had scientific training to some degree. So if you look at it through what they knew at the time, it's a little bit like Crazy Percival Lowell and his canals on Mars. If you read his books from today's perspective, they're silly, but when you really dig in and think, okay, what did he know at the time? He was following pretty good scientific logic, and H.G. Wells was too. It's just from now, it's kind of quaint looking.
And you know, you said that the message of the movies, of this movie, and the British Empire and humanity in general, in the end, they're watching the astronauts, the current astronauts, on the moon, and they go to the former dwelling of the creatures, and none of them is there, and the place is crumbled, and they hypothetically think that they might have been destroyed by a virus that right. had been brought to them by
Cavour.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, the main guy at the end laughs and says, "Oh, Cabo did have a terrible cold." And you're thinking, okay, so this is lunar genocide of the first extraterrestrial yeah. culture we've ever met. And you're laughing about, you know, it's just his character is just.
Well, you know, the crazy guy. British humor. What can I say? Well, Rod, we're out of time, unfortunately. But I'm looking forward to our next time. And I did like these movies. Don't feel like you made me watch them.
Okay.
I mean,
I'm grateful. Thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. Have a
All
good
right,
night.
Take care, pal. All right. Thanks.
Thanks. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN.